You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
It is seemingly exactly 2:30, so we thought we'd do a very un-European thing and start directly on time. Welcome everyone to Brookings. I'm glad that everyone has found their way through the freezing cold outside. I'm Fiona Hill, the Director of the Centre on the United States and Europe here at the Brookings Institution, and I'm really delighted that you've been able to join us for this event, which marks the launch by Brookings Press of a new edition of one of the seminal books of this year for us, Saving Europe. It's one of the definitive studies on the Eurozone crisis and the efforts at the highest levels of the EU to tackle it, and also covers all of the ongoing economic and political fallout from the crisis, which, of course, I think is the reason why all of you are here today. The author of the study, Carlo Bastasin, is one of Italy's most distinguished economists and top financial journalists, and he's also been a visiting scholar with us here at Brookings and also with the Peterson Institute across the road, and he's still a non-resident fellow here at the Centre on the United States and Europe. And as you saw on the way into the auditorium, we're selling copies of Carlo's book. These are advanced copies, and Carlo will sign copies for anyone and would like them signed after the event. Brookings has been very heavily involved on a number of fronts about analysis of the economic crisis and the Eurozone crisis across many parts of the institution. So it's not just the Centre on the US and Europe, but it's also our programme on global development, our economic studies programme, and many other parts of the institution. And this panel will reflect that research, as well as the research of our colleagues from the Peterson Institute across the way, and many of the other think tanks here at Brookings. And in a moment, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Doug Elliott, from Economic Studies, who will frame the proceedings for us and introduce the members of the panel. But I would just like to say, before we start, that the next few months of this year are actually going to be very critical for the future of the Eurozone and for the future of the European Union. And that's not justly on the economic front. I mean, all the news in the papers today about Europe falling deeper into recession after what seemed to be a very brief period of recovery or perhaps just a lull in the crisis, but also on the political front. I mean, most of you are well aware that we have some key elections coming up in Europe. And, of course, we've also got so many other crises on the European front, not least the terrible incidents in Paris of today with the attack on one of the most famous French satirical newspapers. It's a very difficult period that we're in Europe on many different dimensions. But we have the Greek elections at the end of this month. And then we have elections in the United Kingdom in early May, and both of these look set to bring to prominence populist parties with anti-EU agendas. So this could, in many respects, if these elections lead to the outcomes that people are speculating, could lead, in some respects, to the respective exits of these two countries from some of the European Union institutions. We all know that Greece has been flirting with some time with the question of exit from the Eurozone. And, of course, if the elections in the UK take a certain turn, there could also be the question of a referendum about the UK's continuation within the European Union. Both of those outcomes would, of course, devastate the whole European project of integration and would also undermine, to some degree, many of the long-standing premises of transatlantic economic, political and security relations. So overall, we have very high stakes over the next few months. And Brookings has a whole series of other events, beginning with this event on the book Saving Europe, let's hope we can, on these topics, the Eurozone crisis, the developments in Europe overall. And many of the members of this panel you will be seeing featured in these events coming up, and some of our other colleagues. And just as one preview, I'd like to mention to those of you who are here, in the next couple of weeks, our colleague David Wessel, who's sitting down in the front, who runs the Hutchins Centre on Fiscal and Monetary Policy, will be having two other events. On January 14th, he's hosting a discussion with David Lipton, the number two at the IMF, along with Barry Eichengreen, who's an economic historian at the University of California, Berkeley, and Christopher Brummer, a professor at Georgetown Law School, on the future of the Eurozone and the challenges of European Monetary Union. And then David will also be having, on January 16th, a conversation with Lucretia Reichlin, who is the former Director General of Research for the European Central Bank and also a Professor of Economics at the London Business School. So we'll be having more on these topics. And as will our other colleagues, Kemal Dervish and others, will also be hosting events in the next few weeks and months. So we hope that you will attend these as well. But in the meantime, we're delighted that you're here for the release of the new edition of Carlo Bastasin's book. And without any further ado, I will turn over to Doug. Thank you again, everyone, for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Fiona. You're not actually here to listen to me, so I will keep this relatively brief. First, let me second Fiona's comments about Carlo. Carlo really is one of the leading thinkers in this area and is very well connected with key decision makers across Europe, having interviewed them for years and gotten to know them in other ways. And this book is a great book. I do recommend, if you have not already purchased your copy, you should do so. I think Carlo has done a superb job of giving a lot of behind-the-scenes detail of how this whole crisis has proceeded in the key European institutions. I won't say more about Carlo, because you have written bios for him and for the other participants here today. The way we're going to do this event is that after I sit down, Carlo will talk a little bit about these issues and about his book. We will then assemble a little panel up here along with Carlo as a continuing participant, and we will have Kamal Dervish and Nicolas Véran, who will talk, give some of their reactions they have. I may add some comments of my own. We'll hear what Carlo has to say about that, and I might ask a few more questions of them, then we'll give you all a chance to participate. You have the bios for Kamal and for Nicolas in front of you. Let me just say, most of you probably already know who each of them are. Kamal has been an important fixture in Europe and in the world for some time now, starting with when he was the Minister for the Economy in Turkey and was integral to saving them from a major economic crisis. What was that, early 90s? Is that roughly right? Early 2000s. All right, so I'm off by a decade. I'm getting old. It all kind of blends together at a certain point. Thank you for that correction. And he also ran the United Nations' development program. Now he, I am pleased to say, is our vice president here at Brookings in charge of our Global Economy and Development Program. Nicolas is at the Peterson Institute, as we always say, across the street, and also at Bruegel, which he helped found, which is a major think tank in Brussels. He's had a career in both the public and private sector, and I think he does a superb job of bridging many communication gaps between private and public, between Europe and the U.S., and I would say in addition to his general knowledge of Europe, he's done a great deal of work on the financial sector in Europe, including helping to push along at an early stage the concept of banking union. So we have a great group of people here. I will get out of your way. I'll let Carlo talk, and then we'll come back for the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, everybody, for coming. As Doug kindly said, this is the second edition of the book. But if the crisis goes on as it promises to go, we might get familiar, I guess. This would become a regular appointment for us, which is a bright side, probably, of this crisis. I need to thank a few people before saying a few words on how I see the European situation at the moment. First of all, Fiona, apart from your exceedingly generous introduction, the kind of professional and human environment that you and Andy have created around the center was essential for doing this job. And I feel very honored to have Kamal, Doug, and Nicolas today as interlocutors for this debut of the book, and very much look forward to hearing what they have to say. Last but not least, I have to thank Brookings Press and Valentina Kalk particularly, and the colleagues at Brookings Press, who actually believed in the book before the author himself. My serious concern was how to put an end to an endless story. And the fact is, in fact, as the first edition already was, even this second edition is built around facts, events, people, anecdotes, some pieces of analysis. And you see every day new pieces of evidence showing that this is a development, a flow of events. Today we have, first of all, dramatic news, and let me offer condolences to the French for what is going on in Paris that strike all of us, but may have an impact on our perception of an open society. And so in the interaction between countries, which is the essence of European coexistence in this moment. But this very day, we have news about divergent paths of unemployment in the European countries. Somewhere unemployment hits record lows, and in other countries it hits record levels on the upside. And for the first time today, after 55 years, we see the continent fall into deflation. So make a point in this continuous flow? Well, my attempt was to find an analytical bedrock which would allow us to watch behind us, behind the shoulder, and understand more of what has gone awry or gone right, and help us understanding what is happening down the path. And that's what I would like to offer to you today, and I would synthesize this concept in a slightly provocative definition, according to which Europe is undergoing its first war of interdependence. I am not using the war word lightheartedly. Frankly speaking, I think we shouldn't abuse of this category, especially speaking of financial crisis where antagonists, if not enemies, are not in front of us, are normally beside us, between us. Still, there are some reasons why I want to break the wall and bring this word to the fore. And the first is that the size of the economic crisis, the loss of production as measured in terms of loss relative to the trend, is in the ballpark of a war. It actually amounts to a higher economic cost than all the American wars fought after 9/11, Iraq and Afghanistan included. But the real reason why I am not shying away from the word conflict, war, is that I really believe that the root cause behind the, or at the origin of the crisis, and behind the disappointing management of the crisis, is a bellicose concept. And let me get straight to the point. This crisis is generally acknowledged as a crisis of the European idea. Countries are viewed as too different, and civic cultures as too diverse, and consequently, policy preferences by the people, probably irreconcilable. Well, my point is that diversity is not a problem. Diversity is a plus both in the theory of economic integration and in political dimension. Maybe a value added, not a problem. But what I see at the origin of the crisis is something different. It's actually something that is a common feature to all the governments that have contributed to manage the crisis. And those governments have acted as if the states were or had to become self-sufficient, to live within their own means, to stand on its own feet. And this antagonism between self-sufficiency on one side and interdependence on the other is more profound than meets the eye, actually. The very idea of self-sufficiency goes back to the dramatic historical experience of each European state. Being self-sufficient or non-dependent from foreign economies was a necessity, probably was even vital in the past 250 years, when European states fought approximately 150 wars and 600 major battles on the European soil. And how can it be that such a cultural legacy is still forging the governing culture in Europe in an environment which has a degree of interdependence which is unparalleled in the world? Well, if you think of where Europe comes from, the first antinomy, the first antagonism, as Chancellor Helmut Kohl once expressed, is Europe is a matter of peace and war. And in a way, self-sufficiency and interdependence, when they conflict, they repropose this antagonism between peaceful, positive integration and conflictual self-sufficiency. I want to give you a couple of examples of how self-sufficiency was dominating the way the crisis was conceived and managed. And the first goes back to the beginning of the crisis, actually, autumn 2008, when the financial crisis erupted, and the decision was that each state had to take care of its own banking system as if they were nationally independent. Actually, there were global banks in each national state. There were global banks entirely interdependent, but the decision was everybody has to protect its own banks, although it was clashing with a clear perception of interdependence. And this predates the time when mistrust erupts and Greece and we assist to the Greek admission of George Papandreou admitting that the precedent governments had cooked the books. But when the sovereign crisis erupts, new forms of self-sufficiency come to the fore under the policy prescription that each state had to achieve a balanced fiscal budget and a balance of payment in equilibrium. Once you have internal and external equilibria in these two balances, you don't need to import any capital from your neighboring countries. You're financially sterilized. You're in a way a modern way of a closed state. Closed state is a political category that goes back to the political philosophy of the end of the 18th century. German philosopher Joachim Gottlieb Fichte spoke of a handelsgeschlossener Staat, a state closed to the trade, with pacifist intention. If you are self-sufficient, you don't need to invade other countries. Fact is that this condition of self-sufficiency runs against any rationale for an economically integrated area where capital must be free to flow in the search of the best resource allocation, where capital is most productive. It's not important where the capital comes from or where it goes to. If you're an integrated area, you need to let barriers down. So the point is, what happens when self-sufficiency conflicts with interdependency? And I wish to be clear, I think that being self-reliant or being self-sufficient, in my view, is not absolutely not a negative. I have a lot of sympathy, particularly for the German insistence on some degree of self-sufficiency. And we all know that Germany's insistence at both the individual and collective level on the fact that everybody has to live within his own means stems from the attempt to avoid, to repeat a past which was made of excesses, crimes, poverty, debt, inflation. And this has created a strong ethic at both the individual and collective level of living within, even below their own means. But when this exercise extends to a whole area living below their own means, it backfires in terms of bad interdependence, and you have deflation. You have a paradox, somewhat paradoxical exercise of collective self-sufficiency. And this is essentially the problem of defining a positive interdependence relative to the need of some degree of self-sufficiency. When this is difficult to make, when it is difficult to define the two concepts together, then you normally have a serious problem in the management of the coexistence. And in fact, this is what has happened. Self-sufficiency has become a dominant category, disregarding the need for independence, and it has transformed into forms of crisis management which actually remember the categories we use in military diplomacy, in strategic tension conditions. And I'll list you a few examples. When you propose as a solution for a country in crisis deflation or outright recessions, cutting its GDP by 20-30%, it is inevitably reminiscent of when defeated countries were taken away a part of the territory. And if you think that the first loans were made at punitive terms, as if they were war reparations, even though they helped the banks of the creditor countries, then you see again an asymmetry in the relation between creditor and debtor countries. This has transformed into a rhetoric where creditors have forged the narrative of the crisis, as exactly as it happens when history is written by the victors. And governments have often resorted to warlike secret diplomacy through unaccountable bodies, sheltered by the public scrutiny. And we know that democracy's sometimes been put on second rank. Elections have been postponed. Referenda have been repeated. And in a way, economic inferiority has coincided with political minority. But even countries that were in need have communicated to those governments in need, have communicated to their citizens, saying that the needed reforms, the reforms that they needed to embrace, had been imposed by a malevolent occupying force. Well, this is a logic of past centuries. It's a logic that does not feature as the most important fact the economic and political interdependence. And once self-sufficiency, the principle of each state being isolated in fighting this crisis, has prevailed, then even the institutional set in Europe has changed. The euro area in particular has taken distance from a practice of democracy and solidarity, and politics has been put on a back burner and has turned into an intergovernmental euro union structured hierarchically according to judicial and technical principle characters rather than solidaristic or democratic features. And this is particularly embarrassing for two countries, for Germany and Italy. The fact that conflictual terms of a relation to other states prevail is particularly embarrassing because those two countries have inscribed in their fundamental laws the refusal of war and delegated, as many other countries have done, to Europe, the support for peaceful cooperation. But let me try to understand why interdependence has been so clearly neglected. And my suggestion is that probably we are used to be concerned with interdependence as far as real economy indicators are of interest. For instance, factor mobility. But we have seen a relative little mobility of labor when it has happened more out of desperation than out of integration. Foreign direct investments have declined instead of increasing during the past 6-7 years. Fiscal spillovers are actually less significant than we expected. And trade bilateral, multilateral trade within the euro area has been less significant than we thought, and probably it's been overshadowed by the increase of global trade rather than euro area intra trade. But why are we so probably interdependence seemed not so important, but why are we fixated on real economy interdependence? Because behind this interdependence, we try to find the movement in wages and capital rents, which are the reference of political category in European public discourse. Left-wing and right-wing distinguish themselves according to the privilege that one devotes to wage increases or to capital rents preservations. But what we missed, being again, once again, as in the case of war, this is an ancient legacy still present in the current European public discourse. Also in the case of the real economy, it's an ancient legacy still overshadowing the modernity of the facts that we have to grasp and to disentangle. What we missed was financial interdependence. I could provide you dozen of examples of how important financial interdependence has become with the adoption of the euro. I'll give you just one. If you sum the net financial external position of the three largest creditors, Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands, and you make the difference with the three largest debtors, which are Greece, Spain, and Portugal, you see that the distance has increased by a factor of 4 in the last 10 years, and it's now equivalent to 40% of the euro area GDP. There is no single region in the global economy that is so interdependent, where debtors and creditors are so closely linked. But we are not used to consider financial interdependence as a political factor. But for the fact, the financial interdependence has some peculiar and new features. One, for instance, is that it is enormous as a size, as we have seen. The second is that it's extremely rapid. It's much faster than any parliamentary decision. And it has an incredibly political impact because it impacts the state financing, so the level of taxes, the level of public expenditures. It goes right to the core of the state's internal degree of coexistence. So that's why probably, and I'm ending this this presentation, that's why probably we are so interested whether the ECB or some other institution will be able to find a financial remedy. But what we cannot overlook, talking about quantitative easing or Eurobonds or whatever we are thinking in this moment as a financial solution to the crisis, is that it is profoundly political. It's not technical. And it's a rediscovery of the principle of interdependence as opposed to self-sufficiency, with the meaning, the political meaning of sharing sovereignty and the human meaning of being interdependent. Thank you.
So until the mics are live. I always feel like I should sing or something. Those of you who have heard me sing will disagree. Do you sing, Kamal?
In primary school, it was my biggest fear.
I won't make you do it.
Fair enough. All right, that sounds like I'm on now. So, come on. First, could you tell me a little bit what your reactions are to what Carlo has said and to the book?
Well, I really, really appreciated his presentation. I think it's time is short, so he had to touch on many things without really opening it up. But let me try to be a little bit telegraphic. Hopefully I will succeed.
Okay.
The things may not seem totally connected, but I think they are. I hope they are. And then we'll kind of... The first point I want to make is that the subject is globally important. When you travel in Asia, sometimes you meet some Asian friends who say, you know, at the end of the day, Europe, Eurozone is a kind of small geographical appendix of Eurasia. And, well, they don't seem to be handling themselves very well, but so what? Well, it's not quite that. I mean, Europe is no longer the center of the world, but it is still, if you take the whole of Europe, about 30% of world GDP and a lot of production, ideas, technology, emotion, and ideology. And ideology in Europe has always been very dangerous and infectious, so we have to... Second point I'd like to... So it is, we are in a global topic. It's not just about a small part of the world that we're talking about. And by the way, I don't think the U.S. Growth rate can continue at this pace if the European crisis further deepens. I think there's too much interdependence between the two economies. Second, I do believe that to a great degree, the crisis is policy and politics inflicted. Just as I am one who believes that the Great Depression was largely policy inflicted. I won't have, you know, I don't, I, it, it was not, it could have been avoided, but there were political variables that had to come into play. And here the, two central ideas is that, as we saw also in the U.S. crisis, and as I also believe that many have learned, others still don't think so, but capitalist markets don't work on their own. They're essential for a dynamic economy, for growth, but they need good governance and good government to function, to give their result. And when the two things don't match, and Carlos touched on how they don't match, particularly the financial area, when you don't have a governance that matches what's actually going on in the market, you run into deep problems. Now, there are two things that I won't have time in this very brief moment to elaborate on, but I think there are two essential features of the reality and the challenge we face. There is need for closer economic union. The kind of interdependence Carlos mentioned in the economic governance sphere requires a much stronger political integration of the Eurozone in terms of at least the economic policy mechanisms. Not necessarily defense or not necessarily other things when we compare to the United States, for example. It doesn't necessarily have to replicate the United States, but it does have to have mechanisms of financial and monetary governance which allow a sovereign common currency and which has robbed these countries of their central banks. I mean, one thing I think one always needs to reflect on is how come the UK 3-4 years ago could borrow at such wonderful rates, when, in fact, the fiscal mess and many other aspects of it were just as bad as many parts of the Eurozone. Now, the UK has done reforms and has done better over time. We can debate that. But certainly, if it hadn't been for the existence of the Bank of England behind the currency of the UK, we would have a very different situation. And, you know, as you have taken away that instrument from the individual European sovereign nations, it doesn't work anymore. You have to build something else in exchange. So that's one. I can't go into details. The second is deep social reforms are necessary, definitely. You cannot blame all on the macroeconomics. From labor markets to product markets to retirement to many, many other parts of the European setup, there are deep reforms that are needed. Again, these do not need to mimic the United States. You don't have to import the kind of American system into the Eurozone for it to work. There are other things one can think about. A new social contract is needed. Aging is a major problem. Clearly, in such an aging society, which at the same time has tremendous resistance against immigration, like most societies do, when the volume of immigration becomes large, then clearly a lengthening of the working age is absolutely essential. But how you structure it, how you finance it, how you build it, how you ally it to a lifelong education system, these are the kinds of reforms, structural reforms, Europe has to go through, which will take time. And one of the big problems now, one of the big, even if everybody agrees on these two things, I'm making a caricature, the Germans are saying, well, we'll be happy to relax if we're sure that all these reforms go through in France and in Italy. But, you know, these reforms will go through over 3, 4, 5 years in the political cycle. They cannot be a signature that everything will go as they please. I remember once negotiating with the IMF, and the IMF wanted me to sign a letter of intent giving them the results of the negotiations we had on the real wage with the unions. Well, I said, sorry, in a democratic country, I cannot. You know, the unions negotiate with the employers and something comes up. You cannot sign up. I will try to be, you know, convince people to be reasonable, but I can't sign such a paper. So there's this contradiction that I think in Germany there is actually willingness to be more reasonable, but they want a counterpart. And the counterpart is undeliverable except in a much closer union, where the legitimacy of the political decision comes from that political union and not from German or Northern imposition or Brussels imposition. So I think that is where we're stuck. I think Europe has excellent skills, excellent enterprises, excellent in many areas of technology, great successes, maybe not as great as Silicon Valley or the US, but still very high up there, in many cases better. The famous European train designs and things like that. But the politics isn't there. And I mean, I'm very always upset when, as an economist, I have to kind of admit that the politics are so important. but you need the politics. And now, in the politics, and here I'm going to be a little bit, I hope, not controversial, but you have a UK problem in Europe. You have a serious UK problem. I lived it when I was part of the European Convention to try to draft the European Constitution. As far as I could see in that convention, the job of the UK delegation was to make sure that whatever came out wouldn't amount to anything. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, okay, but not much. So, on the other hand, I do believe that the UK is part of the European family, is needed for all kinds of other reasons, particularly for the global balance, for relations with the US and many other things, and many good ideas come from the UK. So therefore, one needs to find a political design that keeps the Europe, that keeps the UK in a wide Europe, but allows the Eurozone to move ahead much more rapidly in a quasi-federal economic direction. You have to have a narrative. I mean, all these technicalities, you know, in terms of votes, in terms of election debates, are hopeless. One needs to have a much more simplified narrative. And I think this separation within a large Europe between the UK, who doesn't want the integration, and the rest of Europe, where the majority actually wants it, I think is essential to coming up with the right narrative. And final point, I'm thinking of writing an article tomorrow or this weekend on this, Sweden versus France. There is now, in the political setup in Europe, a situation where the moderate center-left and the moderate center-right compete, as they should, but neither is strong enough in many countries to have a majority anymore. Some extreme party, and often an extreme right party, like Marine Le Pen in France, the Front National, is getting almost as much as the center-right and the center-left. And is on top of it borrowing from Vladimir Putin, who generously supports them financially, which is kind of interesting, extreme right, Moscow finance. Sweden, in France, the right and the center-right and the center-left are at total loggerheads. There seems to be very little space for agreement. And as far as I can see, Nicola maybe has some, I'm sure has some views on this and others, you know, the Front National is profiting from that. In Sweden, something very interesting happened. There was a big rise of the extreme anti-immigration populist right, and the center-right and the center-left decided, okay, we're going to do a pact. We're going to support each other, even in minority governments. The center-right is now going to support the Social Democrats. There won't be any elections. The Social Democrats will run a minority government supported by the center-right. And if in the next elections the center-right is in the same position, has more votes than the Social Democrats, then the Social Democrats have promised to support the center-right. So you have a kind of moderate European coalition coming together against the extreme. Is it the solution? I personally think so. I think the situation is getting serious enough that one has to rethink the political alignments. There is a counter-argument, which I admit is also a strong one. Then that leaves the extremists as the only opposition, criticizing everything and maybe leading to more votes. So I don't think it's such an easy position, but I do think it's worth thinking very carefully about. Thank you.
Thank you. Kamal? Nicola?
Well, thank you very much. I guess I should start in the spirit of transparency that is now shared by all think tanks in Washington to say that Carlo is I consider Carlo a very close friend, so don't consider me neutral here. He was generous enough to have me for a few days in Tuscany this summer, so I should. you should all be aware of this. Now, having disclosed that, I think this is really a unique book. And let me just give, as an illustration, a more neutral observer, Olli Rehn, when he was European Commissioner for economic and financial matters, mentioned that was asked. There was a Bloomberg survey at the beginning of 2013 of a number of luminaries in Europe. What was their best book of the year? And he was the man in charge of this in the European Commission. And the book he mentioned was the first edition of Carlo's book. So that tells you something about why this book or how this book is so important. Carlo is also, as I think has already been mentioned, unique in the way he combines being a journalist and an economist, or I don't know whether I should say an economist and a journalist. But more importantly, a very original thinker and living in the community of think tanks, you know how to that makes a difference between people who just repeat ideas they've found in other places and people who have original thinking of their own, which obviously are generally a minority. And I've been impressed always by Carlo's political intuition. I think he exemplified this in his presentation today. The book makes trenchant observations. I'm not going to summarize it, of course. Just let me, for once, make a remark as a Frenchman that was mentioned. By the way, I echo Fiona's reference to the tragedy in my home country today. And I will only say that in addition to a number of innocent people being killed, some of them were great artists, which have contributed a lot, and so that compounds the sadness. Having said that, so I think one of the observations that Carlo makes on France is something that is typically something that is a taboo in European thinking, in Germany, in Paris, in Brussels, which is the end of France as a political center of gravity in Europe, and basically the death of the French-German couple. And I think making it as explicit and as analytically supported as he did in the book is testimony to Carlo's unique analytical stamina. Now, a discussion should discuss, so let me do that. It's a pessimistic book. The subtitle is Anatomy of a Dream, but you really have a sense at some point that this is Autopsy of a Dream.
You're right, that was meant.
And indeed, the last chapter refers to a dreamless night, which is not the most sunny way of describing the current situation. So if Europe is defined as a European dream, not the Chinese dream, not the French dream, not the American dream, but the European dream, titling the last chapter, Dreamless Night, certainly means something. And I think what Carlo's point here is if, and he will correct me if I understand it wrong, is that basically politics remains stubbornly national. Ideology or ideation remains stubbornly national. The EU has failed to create a European level of politics, whether you call it the demos or whatever the name is. The emblem of this is Sarkozy's words, which I think Carlo has powerfully contributed in making famous. Chacun sa merde. I won't translate. Carlo translates it in his beautiful, elegant way. He translates it to everyone his or her own merde, which I think is a is the right one. And in this landscape, the only truly European actor is actually the ECB. And it's a truly European actor precisely because as a central bank, an independent central bank, it's non-political. So all the rest is intergovernmental. That's where we stuck. And the implication, even so, I don't think you make it explicit in the book, is that tasks and responsibilities will pile up over the ECB on the Mr. Draghi's shoulders and his colleagues. And up to the point they become unsustainable. Basically, the ECB cannot support this burden of exclusive responsibility for all things European, and that may lead to future collapse. This is not made explicit, I think, in the book, but strongly implied. So for the sake of discussion, I will try to be slightly more optimistic, not spending much time. Just mention three things that make me optimistic. So the first is anecdotal. One of the exhibits that Carlo uses to say, well, everything is intergovernmental in Europe is the fact that both the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, and the Single Resolution Fund for addressing future banking crisis, so basically the two mutualized pots of money that have been created for an indefinite period in this crisis. There was also an EFSF, but I'll forget that acronym. In the crisis, they've been created by intergovernmental treaty, not as part of the community framework. And that's taken as a proof that governments will never release that sort of fiscal or financial sovereignty. I would suggest an alternative explanation, and I think actually Carlo does mention some of the vagaries of the negotiations that led to that outcome, certainly in the case of the ESM, which is just a UK question. And I thank Kemal for having mentioned that, because I think it's a very central question now in Europe, and you cannot really look at the EU without the UK, but also look at the Eurozone without the UK, because we shouldn't forget that the institutions of the Eurozone, and institutions certainly matter, including the ECB, are EU institutions, not Eurozone institutions, governed by an EU treaty. And I would argue that the only reason, or the real reason, rather, that those two funds, ESM and SRF, are set up or actually governed by an intergovernmental treaty, it's a community legislation that sets up the SRF, is because of the UK question, which is not to say the problem is resolved, but to suggest that it's not just the fact that EU institutions are incapable of handling money. The second point is more controversial. It's the election of Jean-Claude Juncker as president of the European Commission, and I'm not going to enter into a long argument, but I think if you look at how it happened in the course of the month of June 2014, I won't say this was a mechanism of democratic legitimacy or accountability, but I will say that the reason Juncker was chosen when basically all member states, including Germany, France, all the way down, and the UK, of course, didn't want him to be appointed. The reason he was in the end was because of the democratic aspiration that was located in EU institutions by public opinion, including in Germany, that explained the final choice. The third example, of course, is banking union. Banking union is the most convincing example of institutional buildup at the EU level that has resulted from the crisis. It's here to stay. It's incomplete. Carlo mentioned that in the book, but I don't think it can be dismissed. It's much more than muddling through. It's a very radical move. So let me conclude I believe what makes this crisis unique, the European crisis, and also very difficult to understand, I may add particularly difficult to understand for Americans, is that institutions in Europe are endogenous. In the US and also in the UK, there has been this extraordinary institutional continuity, right? In both countries, in the UK more than 3 centuries, in the US more than 2 centuries. That's much longer than human memory. So basically, institutions are exogenous. They're taken as a given. They're taken as stable. There are some adaptations. They're always marginal and incremental. The EU is different. And the institutions are not an independent variable. They're a dependent variable. The ideologies even may be dependent, not independent. It could be, it's a bit early to tell, that the European crisis will lead to new ideologies and new elements of political culture. But certainly institutions are dependent. That's undeniable. And I think that makes the European crisis just an order of magnitude more complex, because institutions are at stake and in play, than a normal crisis, so to say, where only policies are in play. And this complexity makes the crisis protracted. It makes the crisis very long to resolve. It makes it also fascinating to analyze, and I think this is why a book like Carlo's, which again I think is really unique among all that have been published so far on this subject, is really indispensable. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Nicola. I'll just add 3 comments of my own, and then I'll give a chance for Carlo to speak. One is, I was interested that Kamal started quite early on talking about Asian views about this. I've had the opportunity to speak multiple times about the euro crisis in Europe, the U.S., and in China. And I found it fascinating. In Europe, I was seen as somewhat pessimistic, though not nearly as pessimistic as many Americans seem to them. In the U.S., I've seemed somewhat too optimistic, because I have generally believed that Europe would muddle through, though there are downside risks, there were and are. In China, I was seen as a raving lunatic optimist, because they could not figure out how Europe works in the good years, much less the bad ones. So much of this depends on your perspective as to how countries and economies work. And I think that's important to keep in mind, because the view from here may be quite different from other places. Kamal also, I thought, very intelligently talked about the role of markets in all of this. And I would certainly agree with his premise that markets can't operate effectively on their own. There has to be a very substantial, larger social context and legal and political context. I would throw in an additional point. I believe that part of the problem we've had with the euro crisis that's not often pointed to is, I think, an aspect of it was just part of the larger bubble mentality. That is, I think there was a euro bubble. I think throughout the world, all of us were playing down the levels of risks that existed. And the risks that existed within Europe because of the difficulties of running a monetary union were largely ignored by the financial markets until they overreacted in the other direction, which is how markets tend to work. And then Nicola had mentioned that he thought that, by implication anyway, the book was perhaps a little bit pessimistic. I think by implication, too pessimistic. I'd have to say that is my reading as well. While I think this is a brilliant book on Carlo's part, I think you'll come away somewhat depressed, probably more depressed than you should be. So, Carlo, with that as an introduction.
The first reaction is, I should enlarge the house in Toscana. You definitely earned more than an invitation. Thanks everybody for very insightful remarks. What has struck me researching on that book is, when you talk to protagonists of this story, you see how humanly difficult it is to keep things under control.
there are anecdotes, situation. Well, what comes to my mind is, for instance, a critical summit that happened at the end of 2011 in Cannes. It was a real piece of commedia dell'arte. It was something that goes back to the tradition of theater, where each protagonist was exposed to emotional stress. Famously, the German chancellor broke into tears. And after rather innocuous remarks by the American president, and she got together after a few minutes and then replied, it's not my fault that the Constitution, which I am defending, was written by you. And the personal side and the historical dimension collide. And in some cases, what we see as a strategy is a combination of circumstances. For instance, when Mario Draghi said he would have saved the euro, whatever it takes, well, the reasons why he said that sentence on July 26, 2012 goes back more to temperamental reaction than strategy of monetary policy. It was a peculiar situation when he could not stomach anymore remarks about the death of the euro pronounced at the City of London, where most of the people were dismissing out of hand that the common currency had a future. And he reacted promptly to that situation as a normal human being probably would do, defending what is his affectionate to. And something similar happened, going back to the position of the UK and France, when a very important piece of new legislation was signed, the fiscal compact, as we call it, fixing new and more severe rules about fiscal policy. And the way it became an intergovernmental treaty has to do with the reaction of David Cameron to his requests of defending the fiscal prerogatives of the City of London, which were unacceptable, particularly for Sarkozy at the time. And the two countries, well, obviously the UK decided, well, we will not underwrite this new common treaty, and Sarkozy was all too happy to see the institutional development of this important piece of legislation moved toward the intergovernmental side instead than remaining in the EU legislative framework. Because, well, his Gaullist tradition sees a role for national states more than for common institutions. But at the end, what is the result? What is the outcome for the UK and France? Is that they give way to intergovernmental solution in the European context instead of a common EU institution. And in intergovernmental institution, they favor the stronger government, which is Germany. So in order to contain German, let's say, predominance on the work on the European legislation, they encourage intergovernmental solution, which inevitably favor their German interlocutor. And in this sense, it is difficult to see, to put the blame on one single head of government, to say Merkel was too selfish, whatever we want to say, or the others were unreliable. The whole game was a complex mixture of personal and national cultures that struggled to adapt to a cooperative game. I still maintain that this goes back to the history of national cultures and that we need to look forward, something that Europe has never been good at, that in order to do that, you need to be optimist, and I'm not the person to say
that. All right, I have multiple questions, but I'm going to confine myself to one so that we have a chance for the audience to participate. So, Carlo, what's going to happen?
Just read the book. as I said, what was neglected was the democratic substance of European coexistence in the past 6 years, and we have a chance to bring them back, bring these instances back into the public discourse this year. We obviously are very interested in observing what happens in Greece and later in Spain, Portugal, and in the UK. Let me give you what I understand of what is happening in Greece. Well, first of all, I'm very concerned. Well, you would expect I'm very concerned. I don't think that what happens is in Greece is under control, is irrelevant, that institutions are now stronger than they were 3 years ago or 4 years ago. If Greek takes a very hard stance and takes away credibility to the OMT or to the quantitative easing instruments of the ECB, then contagion can again spread in the euro area. It will require swift action by the EU institutions. But having said that, so saying the situation is not to be underestimated, but having said that, I'm really convinced that even the Greek Syriza leader, the German Podemos leaders, and the other parties that are coming to the fore that have no traditional pro-European line are very aware that the majority of the citizens want Europe to flourish, want to remain in the euro, and compromise is already on the table, I think. So in this case, it's a compromise that considers categories, political categories. It was overdue to consider them into a solution of the crisis. So in my pessimism, I'm optimist. So.
Okay. All right, so if I can translate that from the Carlo, it sounds like you're saying there are serious issues here, but you actually are reasonably hopeful that Europe will once more muddle through and deal with them.
Well, muddle through has a particular...
You can use a different term if you wish.
Well, I'm really convinced that the problem is a problem of commitment, that we have not ruled out the eventuality of a breakup of Europe and of the euro, and that we need a political commitment. We still need this political commitment. This political commitment cannot be provided by the ECB alone. It needs to come from heads of government. This is a situation when you would expect this commitment to come, when people are voting. And after the vote, you cannot easily put aside the requests of democracies. You need to have those requests on the table and see whether they are compatible with the others. It's the first year when political interdependence becomes the subject of the negotiation.
Okay, thank you. Kamal, you wanted to add something?
I think what Carlo said is very important, and I just think that that will require a degree of political cooperation among the pro-European forces that has not existed before. The Swedish example, if you like, in shorthand, should multiply. And I think if that happens, other questions one can disagree on, but if that happens, then I think the political solutions will be much more feasible.
Okay, so I'm going to give you all the opportunity to ask some questions as well. Just a few ground rules.
First, when you're called upon, please wait for the microphone. Then tell us who you are and what your affiliation is. And remember that a question is a question, and that I'm using a singular here. So please try to confine it to one actual question. So, the woman here in the second row.
Yeah, my name is Li Yang. Thanks for your presentation. When we talk about saving Europe, we got to see the problem. And we are talking about financial crisis, we have to see the problem. And a lot of time, U.S. or anywhere, they always think the problem is politics. And yes, politics, but the problem is financial sectors control the politics. You know, people don't have the choice of freedom or who to choose, who are the candidates. And then history is always false statement, false history, so we have to rewrite the history. My question would be really, exactly what are the problems in Europe now as compared to the U.S.? How do you resolve the problem? Like a financial institution in the U.S., it's a foreclosure, it's really a forced foreclosure, they basically rob people's resources. Like a bailout is basically rob not only people's car, but also government bailout. So exactly what's the problem politically, but what I try to say is interpret it in the layman language. Exactly what people, normal general public, the problem they face, and how do you resolve the problem so we can save the society?
Okay, thank you. I know Nicola wanted to respond. Did you want to say anything, Carlo? Or?
Wait, Nicola.
Okay, Nicola?
I think you're right to mention the issue of interdependence between political communities and financial communities. Let's put it that way, in the vocabulary of interdependence, as Carlo would, as a very important driver of the European crisis and indeed problem for Europe. I would note, however, that it takes different forms in Europe from the U.S., and the reason for that is exactly what Carlo has exposed in his initial remarks, which is the weight of self-sufficiency as a driver of how governments think in Europe. So there is a sort of political capture or regulatory capture in Europe, as you see in the U.S., but there is something even more powerful that doesn't really have an equivalent in the U.S., which is what one may call banking nationalism as an equivalent to economic nationalism, which is that governments feel it's a patriotic imperative to push the interests of their banking national champions against the other banking champions from other countries in Europe. So basically, the competition among banks in the financial market is seen by governments as a proxy for the rivalries among nations and driven by this thinking about self-sufficiency, which in economic terms would be translated as availability of financial repression as a tool for governments in a pan-European financial market. And I think this banking nationalism, the commitment of government to their banking champions and to keeping the tools of financial repression has been a major driver of the crisis and a major problem, both in the buildup of risk and then in the inability to resolve it. But I think Carlo's book actually gives extraordinary insights on this, and with anecdotes such as, for example, the role of the saving banks in Germany on a number of policy debates. And so it's another encouragement to really read this book because it does answer your question.
Did you want to add anything, Carlo? All right, gentleman up here.
Hi, Bill Drozdiak. I'm a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings and an advisor with McLarty Associates. There seems to be no prospect of growth in Europe for the next several years. And while there was support for the TTIP negotiation thinking this would provide some spur to growth, there's now been a downturn in public opinion, particularly in Germany, against the trade negotiations. Related to that, you see high unemployment of young people in Italy, France, Spain. How can you turn around public opinion when you have these two powerful forces working against the whole concept of Europe?
Well, I wouldn't I wouldn't rule out entirely the possibility that Europe's come back to a path of growth. I think what is happening on the currency side is very important. What is happening on the side of the price of oil will encourage growth in Europe as well, if prices remain at this level at least. And as for youth unemployment, you're right to focus on that indicator. We shouldn't be misled by the headline saying 50% of young people are unemployed in Spain or Italy. I can give you the right figures. It's 43.4% of the population of the age of young age, between 18 and 24 years, but only 12.2% of those willing to work. The other are students. The other 30% that we count in the 50%, let's say, are students. So there is a we are not in an hysteresis situation. We are not yet in a situation when a full generation has is hopeless and lost contact with the job market. We're still in time to recover these young people. But I'm absolutely I share entirely your point that this is the most important social indicator that we should have in mind. And you're right that there is a link between consensus, pro-European consensus, and unemployment. You can see it's... The last thing I would add is that you can find some strong correlation between the level of long-term real interest rates and growth in Europe relative vis-à-vis the U.S. And an accommodative monetary policy has managed to bring short-term interest rates down at a level comparable to the American one, but not long-term. And those long-term rates are differentiated country by country. I expect quantitative easing to have an effect on inflation expectation and hence on long-term real interest rates. Even though the macroeconomic direct impact of quantitative easing is not to be taken for granted, but the impact on long-term real interest rates is important, and in the time it will reverberate on growth.
Okay. Thank you. Roberto Perle, Cornerstone Macro. Europe is certainly not a very perfectly integrated institution, right, entity. Certainly not from the fiscal side, but I always thought that on the monetary side, it was fairly well integrated. However, now we hear, talking about quantitative easing, we hear that the ECB is considering perhaps the possibility of conducting this quantitative easing program on a segregated basis, whereby each national central bank would buy only their own country's bonds, and the risk would reside with that central bank, not with the ECB as a whole. So this seems to go in the opposite direction of integration, right? Even the opposite direction of the status quo. So how do you think about it? Does this in some sense, go against what Draghi said about the whatever it takes pledge? So what's a good way of thinking about this?
This is certainly one of the options on the table. It's been tabled by the Bundesbank, as you know, and makes some sense if seen from the concern that the Bundesbank has about the fiscal redistribution implied by quantitative easing, by the purchase of sovereign bonds, but it doesn't work. And this is very clear to everybody. It wouldn't work, it would increase financial fragmentation. So you need some other technical solution to implement quantitative easing. And as far as I hear, there are at least three other options. So the one you mentioned is one of four. I don't see how it can be chosen among the other. I'm confident they will pick one of the others, including one that was advanced through Brookings' website recently, which is what happens in quantitative easing is banks purchasing sovereign bonds that are already existing in the portfolios of banks. Those bonds are already there, and it would be easy for the ECB to announce that it is available to purchase those bonds in a fixed proportion corresponding to the capital key of the ECB if the banks themselves package them in one security, an asset-backed security composed by sovereign bonds in fixed proportion as requested by the ECB. At that time, you would have a very strong signaling effect, de facto creating a new safe and liquid asset for the euro area, which is not existent, which is something that global investors are looking for when they want to invest in the euro area. If this will happen, it's a simple technical solution to the euro crisis, but it will have enormous impact on the solution of the crisis. I understand there are objections to these technical solutions, but it's on the table. So we need to see. Part of what we need to see is to see whether the Greek problem is creating predicaments toward a smooth technical design of a quantitative easing. It's maybe too early to say.
Yeah, I'd add one other thing, which is that in Europe, monetary policy primarily operates effectively through the banks because the banks are by far the major credit providers. Therefore, you have interactions with bank regulatory policies. And we already know that some countries, such as Germany, have made it hard for banks to move deposits from Germany to, for example, Italy, even the same banking group that has both Italian and German operations. And so there are government policies, basically, which are furthering that fragmentation. And my hope would be that over time those are reduced. There's a woman back here. No, third row, yeah, that, exactly.
Hi, my name is Barbara Dello, and I'm new to this, but I wanted to, in that short time, I've had some very troubling feelings that lead to my question. The first is I live in a suburb of New York City, and I personally have experienced the resentment of my German heritage many times. And I was talking to my brother about this, and he said to me, you have to remember that for us in America, World War II ended in the 1940s, but for Europe it ended with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And my third thing was a visit to Germany, where I got really saw the frustration among many about the outside economic pressure and the continuation of collective shame assigned to them. My question is, what degree will these cultural issues, do you think, hamper or first of all create the rise of a center-right, or even, you know, as you mentioned, perhaps get in the way of the continuation of the EU?
Carol?
It's an incredibly important question, and thank you for asking. It's very difficult to answer, obviously. As I try to explain in the presentation, I am firmly convinced that cultural heritage is still working in the back of our minds, and that we are still influenced by an attitude to think nationally. And this crisis, unfortunately, has reinforced this attitude, which is not helpful for cooperation, especially in a situation where interdependence is incredibly pronounced. I give you another example, although I digress a little up from the core of your question. In the 30 largest German industries listed at Frankfurt Stock Exchange, the share held by German savers or investors is around 33%. So all the rhetoric about this perfect industrial system producing profits, keeping wages low at home to export profits to the rest of the world doesn't make sense from a national kind of view. If we consider politics as a national thing and politics is centered about the distribution of income, well, there is something that does not fit the picture. This kind of interdependence, there is a way to say the same happens in Italy. In Italy, the share is slightly higher of domestic investors on the largest companies. But this is the situation in Europe. So if we were lucid, observing the reality, the economic reality, we would be much more cautious in defending national borders in an economy which is tightly integrated. And then we would lose the justification for this transposition of national pride into national economic pride. It would look things in a different way, I think. But the thing that happens to you in New York, or we sometimes need prejudices. It's the simplest and cruelest way to have an orientation. Even national states are a form of orientation. We still need some firm grasp in a difficult age where everything is global and we don't see where it begins and where it ends. So it's a matter of, it's a learning process. It's a very painful learning process. And this is optimistic.
Painful.
Yeah, if I can take another angle on the same thing. I mean, certainly a concern that probably almost all of us have had about the euro crisis has been the way that it's brought up ugly national stereotypes. But there's a positive aspect or positive view of this process, which is to say, look at Greece. I mean, most of Europe has terrible views of the Greeks and of Greece. And yet, Europe, and most pointedly the strongest countries in Europe like Germany, have provided a great deal of financial assistance. The reason they have is because they believe that that holding the Eurozone together and holding Europe together has real value to them. So a key question here is always going to be, do the people in each of these countries, which is where the leaders are still elected within the borders of those countries, do they believe that the trade-off is a positive one for them? That for all the problems they seem brought across their borders from the rest of Europe or the rest of the Eurozone, do they get more from it? And so far, certainly the elites in Europe that still largely control these things do believe that in each of these countries. And the general public, for the most part, still does in most of these countries as well, too, though it's a little harder to be sure of that. Anyway, more questions. Sorry.
Just a remark about Germany specifically. I think Carlo eloquently explained why the intergovernmental mechanism of decision-making in a crisis context gives over-proportional weight to the strongest government, and in the European case, that's Germany. In this context, the fact that the legacy of the Second World War and of European dark moments of history actually has a silver lining, which is that Germany, having this burden from history, acts with an extraordinary degree of self-restraint given the power it has in the current institutional configuration. And I think, in a way, we're very fortunate that the biggest country in Europe is Germany, with its sense of self-restraint from history and not another one.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, over there.
Thank you. Thank you, Carlo, and thank you to all of you. Alex Piritaire with ASCGS. This is a question both for Carlo and I think for Nicola as well. Because you mentioned this interdependence and you mentioned the intergovernmental approach that has been taken clearly as a weakness, and I agree with that. But you also point out that the balance of power that is part of the major underpinning of the European Union, which was basically a balance of power between France and Germany, is out of whack at the moment. And clearly, the question there is France, do you both think, come in recent months to the realization that something has gone amiss? And if that's the case, will that modify its approach towards the European Union and towards further Eurozone integration, especially given the fact that for 30 years it was France that had this Gaullist intergovernmental approach and it was Germany who tried to have a more integrationist approach to the European Union. And at the moment we see the Germans becoming somewhat more French and the French not knowing anymore what they are. And I wonder what your views are on that and whether a shift in dynamic can actually be positive in the medium term if something gets unlocked here between Paris and Berlin in particular. Thank you.
Easy question for you, Carla.
Another one. Nicolas, help me. You are more entitled to speak
French. Go first.
French.
You're more neutral.
You're right. Well, during this crisis, strength is not given only by strength, but also by weakness. And in a way, Germany needs France, as we know. What kind of interlocutor will Angela Merkel have in the next months probably does not depend entirely on the bilateral relation between Berlin and Paris. I am pretty convinced that France can find a new pivotal role in terms of political diplomacy. But the game is now much more complicated than it was 10 years ago. The degree of relevance, existential significance of what happens in Europe for each of the 18, now 19 countries can determine the survival of each single government. It's not designing a future of Europe anymore. It's not what governments have experienced in every single country, that their own existence depends on how Europe fares. So I expect France to get back to an important role, but I don't expect the bilateral axis, German-France, to be as important as it was anymore.
Nicolas?
Yeah, I already commented on this in my initial remarks and echoing what Carlo writes in the book, which is the end of France as a sort of political barycenter or center of gravity for European discussions. I will only, and Carlo just put it in a very compelling way, I think. I would argue that indeed Europe has changed from the halcyon days of, you know, Kohl and Mitterrand and Schmidt and Giscard and all that. Not mentioning de Gaulle and Adenauer, which was perhaps a slightly different story, but let's not get lost in that history. Basically, enlargement and deepening. Enlargement, France is no longer as central, Germany is more central. Deepening, as Carlo just said, a number of countries, including in the southern periphery, can just no longer afford to act as if France could be a proxy for their national interest, because things have become just too important and too vital. So basically, the French-German couple is not going to come back. There is a lot of denial of this in both Paris and Berlin, because the French-German couple had become a very useful fiction, especially in the days of Sarkozy and Merkel, for both governments. Germany to appear less powerful than it really was, France to appear more powerful than it really was. But this fiction is now known by everybody as being a fiction. It will not come back. I'll come back to what Carlo was saying, right? I mean, the summit of December 2011, both the UK and France actually undermining themselves by pushing the intergovernmental approach that empowers Germany disproportionately. I think it's a difficult question you ask. If you look at the story of banking union, and how, and I've tried to analyze that in a bit of detail, and frankly, I don't think the definitive history of those few weeks in late spring, early summer of 2012 has been written yet. So maybe that's for another splendid Brooking book. And
I thought that'd be your book.
Well, I'm too lazy. But if you look at that sequence of events, which was very interesting, it actually goes a bit the way you describe. I mean, you had a shift, dramatic shift in the French position, which happened to coincide with the transition between Sarkozy and Hollande, and suddenly France started pushing for a federal position, a federal option for banking policies that it understood was more supportive of its interest than a pure intergovernmental one that hadn't worked. So you can see elements of this, whether it will become a consistent posture of the French government the way it has been, say, historically for Italy, that federalism is good for us because we're more powerful in a federal framework than in an intergovernmental one, I think it's a bit early to tell.
Okay. I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut it there. I know there are many questions, and we promised to finish by 4, at least roughly. And so let's thank Carlo, Kamal, and Nicola for a great discussion.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.